You're watching Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris. With me is Sharad Kutan. Budget 2021 will be tabled in Parliament tomorrow, and there's already been a lot of talk about what this pandemic budget should look like. There's been proposals from the federal opposition, interest groups and think tanks. And tonight we'll hear from some of them. First, we have Dr. Kosri King. He's one of the founders of the advocacy group, the Malaysian Health Coalition. Swee King, the Malaysian Health Coalition is calling for the 2021 federal budget to commit at least 4% of national GDP to the public health care system. Now, this, I might stress, is double the current allocation that is currently given to MOH. Do you see the government making this drastic increase for healthcare? And especially bearing in mind that the government will be seeking to balance competing needs from business, from citizens, all struggling with the economic slowdown and unemployment.
It remains to be seen, and I guess a lot hinges on tomorrow's budget, Melissa. But even if we don't commit to 4% of GDP this year, I think the government needs to make enough moves to increase confidence in the health system by perhaps committing to a gradual increase and very quickly reaching 4% at least in the next 1 to 2 or 3 years even. But it's also important to note that even the 4% allocation, 4% of GDP allocation to health in budget 2021 is not a magic solution to the COVID pandemic that's in front of us, and it's only a partial reversal of the decades of underinvestment in our health system. So while it's not a magic solution, I think it will be a good step forward, and there'll be a few ways that we can think of how to spend the additional funds, Melissa.
Swee King, can you help us understand this number? Because I know in the literature there's some debate about actually a 5% number of GDP said to be emanating from the WHO is much disputed. It says it's kind of more almost mythic rather than real. But help us understand that we're talking about public investment, right? Government investment in public healthcare and not the private sector. And in Malaysia, because we have such a mixed system, what does it do to that number, and where would you like to see government spending go to as opposed to where the private sector is spending its money?
Sharad, you've asked two parts to the question, so I'll begin with the first part by drawing a distinction between Malaysia and also the OECD countries, a group of rich countries usually based in Europe and North America. Malaysia spends 4% of our GDP on healthcare. That's 2% in the public system and 2% from the private system. In OECD, the number is approximately 10% of GDP on healthcare, 8% from government spending and 2% on private spending. So that's 2+2 in Malaysia and 8+2 in the OECD countries. Of course, this is a gross oversimplification, but it gives you an idea of where we are in Malaysia versus the rest of the world. So you can see that we're underspending for a large number of years compared to other countries who've been overinvesting their health system for a large number of years as well. That's where we are as opposed to other countries, Sharad. But let's assume that Malaysia's healthcare system in the public sector receives more funds for budget 2021, here are some ways in which we can spend it. Firstly, in human capital, which means more permanent posts, not so much contract posts, because we have to signal to our young doctors and pharmacists and nurses that we do value their services, meaning plowing some of that money into providing them assured contracts with pensions and EPF, also providing all the allowances that perhaps could have been backdated in the COVID fight. And this would ensure that our frontliners are taken care of, because we need to care for their welfare so that they can care for our welfare. That's the first way that we can spend the money. The second way that we can spend the money is in COVID supplies. And I'm talking here about equipment that are consumables like antigen test kits and PCR test machines, but also longer term vaccines. And also in the super longer term, infrastructure building, more clinics and hospitals and laboratories, especially in remote areas like Sabah, Sarawak and Kelantan. That's the second thing that we can spend on, which is infrastructure, equipment and consumables. Thirdly, is to invest more in universal health coverage, which means as much health as we can provide to as many residents of Malaysia as we can. Right. Obviously, we'll need also to make sure that the funding sources are very sustainable. But the point being that if you have universal health coverage and you can strengthen that in Malaysia, we have some parts of Malaysia having universal health coverage and other parts can be improved. Right. And if you strengthen universal health coverage, it will really improve not only pandemic preparedness, but also the routine non-communicable disease care. Okay. And I'll make a final point, sure. Making sure that the extra money is spent wisely without corruption, wastage, fraud, fraud, abuse and leakages.
Understood. And excellent, I guess, a breakdown of where you're hoping the allocation should go. I'm wondering, Sui King, whether allocation for healthcare funding, in your opinion, should go to the federal level or should be prioritised and disaggregated to the most under-resourced areas. I'm thinking Sabah in particular.
There are two ways to look at this question, Melissa, and both ways talk about equity. The first way is to ensure that there is a per capita spending on healthcare that is equal throughout Malaysia. Currently, Sabah is underspending, compared to the Malaysia average. So for states in Malaysia where they are underspending compared to the national average, we need to top it up so that we can let them catch up to the rest of the country. That is step number one. Number two, you can also look at the outcomes or health outcomes like maternal mortality rates or infant mortality rates, or even the amount of resources available like beds per capita or how many hospital beds per 100,000 population, how many doctors per 100,000 population as well. And if you can use these metrics to equalize the service delivery and available resources for Malaysia, this would be a good way for us to try to achieve health equity as well, to make sure that no Malaysians are left behind when it comes to healthcare.
All right, Sui King, in the minute that we have left with you, when you say overinvest, do you mean creating overcapacity? Because I know there's a debate around this about rationalized healthcare systems that have reduced overcapacity. Where do you stand on this? Will overinvestment lead to overcapacity and wastage?
There is that possibility, Sharad, but what we've seen so far in the pandemic response for Malaysia is that our system is being stressed. And as the Director General of Health has noted, and the previous Auditor General's report as well, Malaysia's health system is underfunded, understaffed, overworked and overstretched, even before COVID. So therefore, any overinvestment will only allow Malaysia to catch up to international standards, and any possibility of overcapacity will be a problem, a good problem to have, that we can deal with in 5 or 7 years from now.
Sui King, always a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much for joining us on the show. Now, we've got on the line Frederick Paulus. He's the economic advisor for the think tank Research for Social Advancement, or better known as REFSA. Frederick, REFSA recently put out a budget 2021 wish list, and in it called for a widening of Malaysia's social safety net. I'm hoping you could clarify which parts of the safety net specifically need widening, and who is it failing now?
Mm-hmm. Hi, good evening, Emmett. I think we were advocating for quite a wide rethink of the social safety net. In particular, I think we highlighted not only in our budget proposal, but also in some earlier work that we did, that we should look to increase the payouts under the Bantuan Sarawak, I think that are currently fairly low. So we're advocating for those to be increased to perhaps the minimum wage level per month, because we see that because of the pandemic, among others, we see a trend obviously towards higher unemployment, but also underemployment. Where maybe people who had fixed jobs in the past were laid off or got pay cuts and decided to move into, for example, Grab drivers or delivery services, etc., which altogether would lower their disposable income most likely, because more people are going into it and the economy isn't doing well anyway. And so we expect that there will be a greater proportion of the population that is actually experiencing a shortfall in their income. And so hence we think the smart thing to do would be to make up that difference and increase the payout so that they can at least maintain their current standard of living and maintain their consumption patterns.
Right, Frederick.
So that's our reasoning behind
it. Right. Frederick, it is not just Malaysians who are suffering from shrinking incomes. It's also the government, right, with crude prices falling, without the GST and so on. So the revenue base is shrinking. We're looking at the recession is providing some more of that dynamic. Where's this money going to come from? I mean, you're asking the government to spend, but surely there might be limits to how much they can spend. And if you're talking about a system, you're talking about a long-term commitment that will be very hard to roll back once it's put in place.
Yes, that's correct. So obviously the fiscal situation of the government is precarious. There is no doubt about it. I think that's also a global phenomenon. So we expect in this budget that we will see substantial deficits compared to the previous years, and probably in line with the other countries, both neighboring countries and across the globe. So I think that's one element that is very clear. But I think it's also important, so we're not just advocating for handing out more money, which is obviously an easy thing to ask. And if we just keep the current system and increase the payouts, that's not affordable. That's very clear. So what we're saying is that we should really look at this problem holistically. And so there are many ways to make sure that people's incomes and standard of living are maintained. So one of the things that we want to work on as well, that we think we should be doing, is to increase the productivity in the economy and reduce our reliance on cheap foreign labor usually, so that we can pay workers higher wages and then reduce the number of people who actually need the additional payouts to maintain their standard of living. There's other systems as well, for example, the employment insurance scheme, etc., which are currently only covering about 60% of the people that would be eligible for coverage. So we're also advocating for incentives to get higher enrollment in those programs, so that we not only increase the beneficiaries, which is good in cases of rising unemployment such as now, but we also increase the contributors, so that there is more money coming into that scheme in general.
Okay.
And then we can manage the costs better.
Frederick,
and then I think...
Sorry to interrupt you. I just want to get your thoughts on, since we're talking about, you know, REFSA's call for more social protection, what do you make of the suggestion to allow contributors to withdraw funds from their account one of their EPF, their pensions fund? Is that symptomatic of a failing social safety net for our country?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say it's symptomatic of a failing safety net, but I think it highlights the sort of acute crisis that we're in for many people. And the risk I see in allowing the withdrawals from the account one is that obviously this will put people at a disadvantage later on when they're about to retire and look to collect their pensions. So I think it's probably not a long-term solution, and it might make things more difficult down the line. And then given the current fiscal situation where everybody is pretty much in the same boat, I think we should use this opportunity to keep our long-term prospects intact and then take the hit in the short term and perhaps borrow more or find some systems to where the government doesn't have to get people to dip into their EPF savings.
Right.
Frederick, when you say, expanding the social safety net, are you talking about a kind of welfare state type of scenario? Is that what REFSA is promoting, considering that, the welfare state has been in crisis for, 30 years in the West now? Tell us, what exactly is the model that you're looking at?
So I think we're not advocating, obviously, to replicate tomorrow the welfare states that exist in Western Europe and so on. But I think it's we can derive some useful schemes and systems from some of these welfare states. For example, the need to have a broad pool of contributors for things like healthcare insurance, for employment insurance, and so on. I think these things very much apply in Malaysia as well. So I think without replicating the excesses and some of the disincentives to work and to competitiveness and so on, I think there are certainly some elements that we could try to replicate here.
Right. Thank you so much for speaking with us tonight, Frederick. We're going to take a quick break on Consider This, but we'll be back with more looking at Budget 2021. Stay tuned.